You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
Hello, it's time for Atomic Show number 104. And with me today, as hinted at in an earlier podcast, I have John Deal, nicknamed Grizz. John is the CEO of Hyperion Power Generation, a startup company that is marketing a small reactor that can be moved to almost any site around the world and operate for, I'm not sure exactly how long. We'll find that out. John, welcome.
Thanks a lot, Rod. Glad to be here.
So you and your company are making quite a splash these days.
For the 10 people that track nuclear energy in the U.S., I think probably we are. I'm not sure about the rest of the population yet, but for sure trying.
Well, there are more and more articles that are showing up in my web searches with the terms new nuclear power plants, and quite a few of them show up with Hyperion Power Generation. Can you help us understand a little bit about the small hot tub sized reactor that you and your company are marketing?
Sure. So this goes back to some work that was done over a 10-year period at Los Alamos National Laboratory by Otis Peterson. And everybody in our company, for some reason, has a nickname. Otis goes by Pete. So Pete Peterson was at Lawrence Livermore and started a couple of their programs there, ended up at Los Alamos, was the science advisor to the U.S. ambassador to Britain, was the Chevron fellow for Los Alamos. He's had a very distinguished career. And he was looking to harness the power of nuclear energy, but do so in an even safer, even cheaper, even more secure manner than traditional big nuke plants. So Pete worked on this design with some folks at Los Alamos off and on for about 10 years. And then a few years ago, a company called Altera Group, which is a venture capitalist fund here in Denver, secured the rights to the technology, and then hired me to commercialize the technology a little over, a year ago last May. So the criteria that Pete was after, there's about five of them, and I'm probably going to get them in the wrong order here, but one of the first ones was that it had to be small enough to fit on the back of a truck, a flatbed truck. And if you could do that, then you could send the power of nuclear energy just about anywhere, whether it's in West Africa, Vietnam, Northern Canada, or, any town USA. So that criteria meant that it was going to be constrained in the size, everything for, how the nucleonics would work. Everything was dictated by that first criteria. The second criteria that Pete had was that he didn't want it to have any internal moving parts. So no traditional fuel rods, no attached cooling towers, nothing mechanical that could break down. The third is that because Los Alamos, their primary responsibility around nuclear energy is really non-proliferation work, and he's very familiar with that, he wanted to create a reactor that would be very difficult to weaponize. I'm not going to use the word impossible, but the idea that it would require sort of nation-state-level resources in order to take the fuel and do anything nefarious with it. I guess a fourth characteristic might be that it needed to be self-moderated, and that kind of went along with the lack of internal moving parts. So he looked to uranium hydride, and for the chemistry kit folks out there, you probably know that hydrides are special kind of metals, and it turns out that uranium hydride is a self-moderating, will, you know, keep a self-moderating chain reaction going just by absorbing or using hydrogen as a moderator, so that the moderator is also the catalyst in this case. So, you know, those are the key features that he wanted in his reactor, and he was able to accomplish that. And then we got involved with this bet about a year and a half ago. And my team does nothing but commercialize technology out of the Department of Energy complex. So we're very familiar with how to work with the government, how intellectual property works, how relationships, and how do you pay for things, you know, all those mechanisms. That's what my career's been around, surrounding for about 20 years.
Okay, so Altria, is that right? Is that how you pronounce it?
It's Altria, Altira, Altria Group, yeah.
Altria Group. So they went and found somebody who's had some experience in commercializing technology in general, not specifically nuclear technology. I guess
right.
There aren't too many people with any experience in commercializing nuclear technology.
People used to
get
arrested or go to Afghanistan. Yeah.
Well, that's just smuggling, not really commercializing.
Yeah, well, hey, it's commercialization. We call the first tech transfer at Los Alamos was the Rosenberg. So
I understand that. And smuggling is probably the world's second or third oldest business anyway. But
that's right.
Going back to interesting nuclear generation. Now, one of the questions that I've had as I look through this is the Hyperion power generation module looks like a great heat source.
Right.
How do you make electricity from it?
Well, and that's just it. And, you know, this is a different approach. I mean, if you look at what NuScale is doing, they're doing some fantastic work in modular reactors that, you know, where you can make a, you know, very traditional size, centralized, you know, electric production facility, or what the Japanese are doing with 4S or whatever. They all integrate the turbine or the electric generation source in. This reactor was originally designed for creating steam for oil sands work and for oil shale work. And for the oil and gas industry. And it's only, you know, in the last year and a half since we got involved that the application to distributed electric or grid-appropriate reactors has become, you know, one of our foci. So it was never designed to have an integrated turbine with it. But the idea is that using heat pipes and using, standard heat transfer mechanisms, we're going to give somebody a bunch of heat. Now, they can use it to heat a military base, right, through steam. They can use it for industrial purposes. They can use it to generate steam, and then they can pick their own steam cycle or their own preferred method of generating electricity, whether that's, you know, turbine for many of the dozens of suppliers out there. So this is a radically different approach, and, you know, one of the reasons why I was hired to lead the company is because, to be honest with you, I don't have any of the, you know, sort of traditional biases of the nuclear industry. You know, I'm a business guy and a marketing guy with a science background, and I've done everything from, you know, imaging satellites to software to other kinds of renewable energy, and my background is in geology and geography. So, you know, that's the kind of person they wanted to commercialize this, just because, you know, they recognize we're not part of the, you know, traditional nuclear industry. We're certainly governed by it. But, you know, our whole approach to the market is we'll bring you the heat and we'll help you on the plant, what we refer to just as plant side planning. But we've got some, you know, great partners we're bringing on to handle all that work. It's hard enough for a startup, a small company, to commercialize, you know, the reactor side of this without also working on everything else. So it was never meant to be a complete electric generation solution. That's not what we're about. We're about providing, you know, this nuclear energy for heat generation.
Okay. Well, I understand that. Now, if someone has a heat demand, what do they? How do they get the heat from your system? Can you just hook a pipe up to one end and get steam out the other end?
That would be one way to do it. And, you know, there are some things that we haven't announced yet about how that heat transfer is going to take place, because I think you've probably seen, you know, a lot of people have seen the diagrams on the Internet where we've got you know, our little reactor buried a few feet underground for aesthetic reasons. But then that connectivity, you know, with the steam cycle or the transfer of heat is something that, you know, we're going to offer two or three options on. We haven't announced that yet, but it's pretty obvious what we're going to do. How we're going to do it is the subject of, you know, several patents. So, and there are some real advancements there, technical advancements, to the efficient transfer of that heat to, you know, to some useful form.
Yeah, I assume that there was going to be some pretty interesting stuff there, because one of the things that has always been a challenge for those of us in the traditional nuclear business is that the reactors are actually pretty simple. The transfer of the heat is a tricky part, and
right,
the part that has caused more of the maintenance and technical challenges than people thought at the beginning stages of the industry.
Okay. Yeah, and you know, I mean, it's you know, if you know about Los Alamos history, and Los Alamos was the birthplace of modern physics, and it's the invention or the discovery of useful nuclear energy, but also they've invented a bunch of other things. Los Alamos is a pretty neat place. You know, they have the world's largest database of influenza and HIV viruses, and the medical industry and the biotech industry regularly use that resource. So they're a pretty diverse group, and one of the things they did was invent the heat pipe, the application of heat pipes. So all those heat pipes up in the Alaska pipeline, you know, were invented at Los Alamos. So there's a hint at some of the intellectual property around this and what we're going to be doing. You know, to a certain extent, our reactor is nothing more than a trigger reactor with some heat pipes jammed into it. But that simple sentence is the hundreds of man years of engineering and you know, physics behind it.
Yeah, I have a little bit of an inkling. I actually work for an organization that's been trying to figure out a better way of heat transfer from reactors for a very long time.
Yeah, there's a lot of different approaches, and what we're trying to do, you know, sort of this is the process of inventing something that we, you know, we plan on producing thousands of these reactors. So it's not the first one I'm worried about. It's number 328 on that I'm worried about. You know, can it be manufactured in a way that where we can get, you know, pretty stable supply of materials? Is that going to be cost effective? Are we going to meet our end user, you know, cost for generation goals? So that's why this is, you know, got some original spin on it.
Right.
You know, that's so, why this is really interesting.
So they brought a guy like you in to pay attention to things like not depending on some sort of exotic material where you're going to define the market
right,
simply by your demand. Yeah, that's
right. Well, you know, the job of somebody, you know, a team, and I, by the way, there's 10 of us doing nothing but working on my end, like, you know, my end of the commercialization. Then we have a whole slew of scientists at Los Alamos, and then a couple partner companies we've been working with that we haven't gone public with because, again, of IP issues and some market entry strategy. But you know, our whole job is to raise money, hire the right team, get through the regulatory process, make sure we have good relationships with suppliers and strategic partners, operators, people that can finance these plants. So, you know, there's an A to Z kind of, you know, business development, marketing, strategic relationship piece, which is what the core non-technical team at Hyperion are involved in.
So are you an Australian?
I'm not.
Well,
we should say that.
Yeah, well, most Americans don't use the term Zed. That's a
normally
an Aussie thing.
Let's see, Dad was in the Air Force, so we spent some time at Okinawa, and I lived in London long enough and have been an Anglophile long enough to where I don't know, maybe it's more phonetic, maybe. It's easier than Z. Did you say E or C or G? Or?
No, I'm just...
I
live in Annapolis, Maryland, and there are a lot of Aussies here.
Cool. My little brother went to school at Annapolis for a couple of years.
A couple.
Yeah.
Did he quit?
We'll stop there. He's a great time. I think when you're on the flight, you know, program, and you decide you don't want to fly airplanes, that it's time to switch you know colleges or universities.
Absolutely. Okay. So we talked a little bit before we started the recording about Hyperion's experience at the Democratic National Convention.
Yeehaw.
Share a little
bit. Boy,
that
was interesting. And you know, I got to tell you that you know, since our approach is look, what we're trying to do is provide, you know, some thermal power to generate electricity, clean water, power small industry. You know, basically, this is essential sort of human services stuff. That's the goal of our company.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because so many people don't seem to understand that the heat supply industry is roughly a $3 trillion a year industry.
Oh,
because that's
yeah.
all that fossil fuels are, is a way to generate heat.
Right. I mean, this energy conversion, right, all energy generation is energy conversion, is really important. And it's really, you know, it's become more and more important as the sort of developed world has taken off and their economies have taken off. And you see China and India coming up, you know, and, I mean, there are still people in India burning sod. And, you know, much less other developing or undeveloped countries where, you know, here's a good statistic for, you know, almost 2,000 people a day die in Africa from lack of clean water. So when somebody from Berkeley or Boulder comes down and starts screaming at me that I'm going to end the planet because I'm trying to use, an energy source that they don't understand, and, you know, they're sort of intellectually dishonest about not trying to understand how it works, it's chemistry and physics, and so therefore if they don't understand it, they're scared. I just ask them if it's okay while you're standing there in, you know, $300 Birkenstocks, wearing your Patagonia jacket, living in your million-dollar house in Boulder, if 2,000 people a day die in Africa because they don't have access to clean water. You okay with that? And they don't know what to say. So I challenge them to learn more about renewable energies of all kinds, including nuclear, because nuclear is the, you know, easiest, cleanest, safest, most regulated, most researched, you know, kind of energy generation you can have. And this is coming from, you know, a left-wing nutball like me. You know, I mean, I was totally anti-nuke when I was uninformed about it, when I was in high school and college, and, you know, hanging out with guys that like to think they were some new incantation or incantation of Earth First. But I got to tell you, you know, you get to a point in an argument with somebody where they say, well, we can just do without electricity, and they pull out their iPhone, you know, to answer a call from their house. You know, it's game over. So
I like to call them Bernards.
Bernards?
Yeah.
Okay.
Did you ever read,
I'm looking for a name.
Did you ever read Brave New World?
Yeah, absolutely. I wondered if that's where that came from.
Yeah, you remember the character who decided he'd go off to the wilderness and quickly realized that everything he depended on was made by other human beings.
That's right. Yeah, it's just, well, anyhow, look, everybody, you know, everybody who's done any kind of, you know, everybody who's self-aware and who bothers to turn on the news at night knows that, you know, we have an issue with generating enough power of some.
Really? Holy cow.
And a clean way for everybody. And, you know, I'm an idealist who's out to make a bunch of money. And, you know, the money is just a way of proving that we've reached a broad part of the market, right? By the way, if you look at what we're trying to do, even generating 4,000 of these little reactors over the next 10 or 12 years, we're going to be like 0.5% of the energy generation in nuclear alone. I mean, it's a trivial amount. So, you know, we're just working on our little thing. You know, it happens to be a huge dollar market because, as you said, heat generation, you know, is $3 trillion. So you get a startup out of Los Alamos and some venture backing, you can create a billion-dollar company. And all you have to do is, you know, sell product because there is such a dearth of new ideas and, you know, this idea of not depending on some centralized grid, or maybe you want to exploit a traditional hydrocarbon, but you want to do it in a cost-efficient manner. You know, there's a lot of angles that attract people to what we're doing, from philanthropic all the way through, you know, big oil and guys, you know, like T. Boone Pickens that are trying to convert us all to natural gas. I mean, everybody has a reason to use some reasonably priced, extremely safe, extremely secure method of generating heat and electricity, and I really can't figure out any other method except for using, you know, the power of the sun, the original power of the sun, and that's, you know, nuclear energy.
Yep.
So,
okay,
so
to
we
the
went
down to the National Convention.
Yeah,
okay.
We went. That's our worldview, right? And we went down and we participated Sunday in the park, and we had a little booth, and people, you know, were buying a patchouli in one stand, and, you know, looking at handmade clogs, and they come to us and they say, what do you do? And it, well, we're here to talk about this new kind of nuclear reactor that we're going to put out there to generate heat and electricity. And about 90% of the people were like, wow, that is incredible. Tell me more. And of course, everybody says, you know, can I have one for my backyard? And that's not what we're doing. You know, our reactor will generate enough electricity for 100,000 people. So the overkill to have it in your backyard, and probably not licensable by the NRC. But the 10% that did, you know, they would say things like, well, I'm just worried about the transportation. Okay, well, let's talk about that, because we thought about that. They didn't want to talk about it. I mean, in most cases, people that were extremely negative about nuclear energy didn't know anything. And that sort of, again, intellectual dishonesty, you know, you're not going to cut through that. So we had a very...
Those people often have a mantra. Or they believe that as soon as they throw out something like the word waste, they think they've trumped the argument.
Yeah, right. Well, people, I mean, even then, people in, that are affiliated, not in the industry, say, well, gee, until we get Rocky Flats operating, we can't. I'm like, you know, the nuclear power generation industry doesn't care right now if Rocky Flats comes online. They have a solution to their waste. They're doing it right now. Bringing on Rocky Flats creates additional variables and potentially additional loads, so I'm of the opinion that, you know, yes, we need to do this. We need to explore recycling. You know, we need to do all the stuff the rest of the world is doing, like Japan and Britain and certainly France. But we're okay today. You know, I've done the research. Nobody has died from a nuclear energy-related accident in the last 30 years. But every year, thousands of people die from hydrocarbons and, you know, either mining, operating, coal plants, you know, natural gas plants, certainly gasoline stations. I mean, this is it's just you know, almost a ridiculous, you know, one-sided argument. But we need to do it, and you know, we are interested in educating the market, and certainly interested in educating people who don't understand or haven't been exposed to the advantages of nuclear energy. And you know, we're having a good time doing it. So we also attended last night. A bunch of us went down there and heard Barack Obama's speech, and he said, safely explore nuclear energy. And so that's what I was waiting to hear. And he said it, and that's great. So.
Yeah, there were a lot of us waiting to hear that comment. It's interesting to me. I mean, Barack Obama does come from the most nuclear state in the country in terms of its electrical generation. I think Illinois has 60% generated by nuclear power. And they also have another one of the national treasures called a national laboratory there at Argonne National Laboratory.
Sure. Yeah, Argonne is, you know, one of the premier labs. I mean, you throw Argonne, Oak Ridge, INL.
Argonne would dispute the idea that Los Alamos was the home of nuclear power. But
yeah, whatever.
they claim there's this thing underneath the squash court, or in the squash court at the University of Chicago, that was the first reactor. So,
well, and they may be right, but yeah, whatever. I mean, the DOE labs are like every other, you know, very intellectual stimulating place, right? It's like big universities that compete for money, and they do compete for resources.
Oh, they compete big time. And one of the things I always heard about Los Alamos, and I've known a number of people who've lived there, is it's the city in the U.S. with the highest concentration of PhDs.
Yep, I think that's true. And you know,
has one of the best public education systems in the world because all the PTA members are PhDs.
Right. Well, you also you may be aware that at least last year or the year before, Los Alamos County had the highest median income in the U.S. at about $93,500 a year. That's median. So that's a pretty significant thing. And they're isolated. You know, it's a lot like a military base because that's the way it was designed. It's a very cool little community, and, you know, they're doing important work up there. I you know, my experience with the DOE labs is runs the gamut from ones that are more, part of a bigger community or industry. Even at Idaho, you know, you've got a a few thousand people, you know, working there in Idaho Falls in a township area of 150,000, you know, the greater sort of metropolitan Idaho Falls area. Los Alamos, you know, I think has 15,000 people there, and virtually everybody's connected to the lab. So
it's a company town.
It is, and it is a great place to raise kids, and it's a great place to work. So, you know, and plus it's northern New Mexico, right? You're at 6,500 feet or something, and it's just gorgeous.
So here's another question for you. This, sure. Help us as taxpayers understand a little bit about the benefit that will come to us as being the intellectual property owners here.
Okay, because that's something that's kind of interesting. You know, the taxpayers through, you know, this technology transfer programs, which it goes back to Bob Doyle and the Tech Transfer Acts that allowed universities to use public money and then transfer that intellectual property to Big Pharma when they invent something new or they come up with a new drug or something like that. That's the same kind of legislation that's applied within the laboratory, the DOE lab system. So in our case, Pete Peterson was working on overhead money. He was not working on a DOE-funded program. So it was a little bit different, a little bit easier for us to secure the intellectual property. But essentially, the lab operator, Los Alamos National Security, goes to the Department of Energy and says, hey, we've got this piece of intellectual property, and we'd like to have the rights to it. And they say, okay. And they generally say, okay. And they do all their checks for, you know, whether or not it's classified or anything, certainly, you know, all of those things that you would want to do from a security standpoint. And then the laboratory has the right to license that technology out to one or more companies. And, you know, Altera, again, had secured the rights through an option and then took that option, you know, and converted it into a full license. So the benefits are that, you know, you've got an opportunity to create a whole new little industry in the U.S. that benefits U.S. economy, creates jobs, focused on small nuclear reactors. Wow, that's a cool thing to do, you know, especially given the broader acceptance of nuclear energy. And the Los Alamos Laboratory, through its operator, owns shares in Hyperion. So they own a small percentage of the company, and they threw their intellectual property in. I should tell you that we've done a ton of work since, you know, this license process started. And we actually, you know, write checks back to the lab. Anybody can hire a federal lab, you know, to work for you. You know, you do this through a work for others or a cooperative research and development agreement. Chevron has a large agreement with Los Alamos that's pretty well publicized. I think Shell's doing some work up there. Big Pharma's done work at the lab, small companies. And Los Alamos has been really successful at transferring technology and licensing, you know, licensing technology out and helping spinoffs get created to benefit the U.S. economy. So it's a very, you know, neat program that allows for publicly funded technology, publicly funded innovations to, you know, help everybody in the U.S.
So how are you guys doing with your NRC arrangements? I noticed in a brief that was probably dated, I want to say March of this year, that your license review is not scheduled till sometime in the 2012 time frame.
Well, we're going to start a pre-application review in less than a year. And, you know, understand that until you show up, you know, it's all up in the air. We plan on being there before then. But the NRC is, you know, as I'm sure you're well aware, and I think your listeners are probably aware, is a cost recovery, you know, agency. So they have to budget in advance, years in advance, to make sure they have resources and people to do the work. And then I think close to 90% of their budget is recovered through industry applicants like us and everybody else in the nuclear industry. So that, you know, was a budgetary kind of consideration. One of the things that will help us, you know, get to the NRC sooner is a customer on U.S. territory. We've announced we have a couple of customers outside the U.S., but the NRC, you know, is built for U.S. Territory. So we have a couple U.S. customers we think we'll be able to announce here very soon, and that'll change our schedule, and that will really drive us through the NRC. If you've got a buyer, you go to the head of the line, and you know, we expect that to happen here in the next few months. So,
now,
but when will we go to the NRC? When we're ready.
Right. Well, of course, you wouldn't want to go to the NRC before you're ready because they charge you.
Yeah, they do, and it's not cheap. They've been very, very helpful. I should tell you that I think the NRC is one of the coolest organizations in the U.S. government.
It is the organization the U.S. government voted the best place to work.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh,
yep.
Wow, that's cool.
2 years in a row now.
I just think, you know, you've got some incredibly motivated, incredibly smart, really nice, open people. And we have had it's not a cozy relationship, but look, they're there to make sure that what we do in the marketplace is safe, period. You know, but there is a lot of excitement around nuclear energy now for what it can bring to the planet, whether you believe in, you know, greenhouse warming or global warming or not. I'm pretty sure it's a good idea not just randomly spew junk up in the air, you know, just particulates and NOx and SOx and things like that. And
yeah, we're all pretty certain that fossil fuel wastes are deadly, if
yeah.
not piped away via big smokestack.
Well, and the thing is, too, you know, people say, well, you know, nuclear is really deadly, you know, in its own, and it is. But let me give you an analogy that may be right on the edge there. There was a time where it was difficult to rock down Main Street, you know, in the morning hours for people throwing out the night pot out on the street. And then society got smart and started installing sewers. And we had indoor, you know, developed indoor plumbing and things. I liken coal and natural gas and hydrocarbon industry to throwing the waste out on the street and making people sick and exposing everybody to that. And the nuclear industry, we concentrate, we focus, we deal with, we deal with waste products in a responsible sort of, you know, manner. So it's really difficult for me to understand how anybody could support, even this, you know, myth of clean coal. I mean, there's no such thing as clean coal. You move it around the waste stream. So, you know, when I look at nuclear power, I recognize the seriousness of it, the issues around security, the issues around safety, waste products, you know, the potential for recycling, never running out of uranium, which would be fantastic, right? We never ran out of fissile materials. Because we had a strong, you know, political response to recycling. It's not a technical issue. Other countries have already done it. So when I look at, the hydrocarbon industry and the myths that they're trying to sell, it almost makes me laugh. But I've spent several years doing nothing but studying this one issue. So,
do you view the hydrocarbon industry as a competitor?
No. Because, you know, I believe that we're going to have for quite some time hydrocarbon-based electric generation. I'm one of those people that believe we're going to need liquid fuels for a long time. Switching over to a hydrogen economy is you still got to generate the hydrogen. People kind of forget that. How are you going to do that? Probably through nuclear energy. And then if you look at something like natural gas, that requires an infrastructure change, which is the same. You know, you get back to sort of the same problem as you do with the hydrogen economy. So I bet gasoline is going to be around for a long time. Certainly, electric-assisted gasoline vehicles are making a big stride, and the idea of having electric cars for a lot of uses will be there. But, you know, I've yet to figure out how to make an electric airplane. So I'm pretty sure we're going to need liquid fuels for a long time. We're going to need the hydrocarbon industry. But I think to the extent we can shift to alternative fuels that are non-hydrocarbon based, and you know, wind and solar both have their hydrocarbon components. You know, if you look at the entire stream, they're extremely dirty industries. You know, making silicon using arsenic. There's no free lunch. Anytime you get involved in energy conversion, you got to deal with the waste stream. You got to deal with the source materials. So, to the extent we can use wind and solar for some high demand resources, or somebody wants to put solar, you know, thermal in their house so they can cut down their heating bill or their electric bill, that's great. But you can't use any renewable energy besides nuclear for baseload power. And that's it. So, we're in a situation here where we're going to have a nice, healthy mix of everything. But the days of, you know, coal plants spewing out, you know, tons of junk every day are over. I don't think the public and the U.S. will stand for it. My only fear is that, you know, it's a lot easier to get into those businesses, and you can use some really nasty coal and coal byproducts, and people in China and India are doing that. So, you know, we've got to transfer that technology through, you know, selling great equipment, you know, to these developing countries so that they don't end up sort of undoing all the good work that Western Europe and Latin America and the U.S. are doing, you know, certainly in Japan and countries like that are doing to minimize their footprint on the planet.
So do you think the hydrocarbon industry views nuclear as a competitor?
I guess that, you know, that's probably a person-by-person kind of poll, right? I think the hydrocarbon industry is an interesting study, and they've got a lot of pressures on them. Some of them are making record profits because they've had record price points from which to sell. And if you make 4% on $100, that's $4. And, you know, 4% on $1,000 is $40. So they're making record profits because of the high prices. It's not that they're doing anything different. It's not that they've gained that extra profit through some miraculous efficiency program, right? So I think that there's always going to be, anytime you get an entrenched industry, you're always going to have some resistance to change. You know, I wish I'd been a fly on the wall almost 8 years ago when Vice President Cheney was holding his, you know, so-called energy summit. It would have been great to stay, you know, for Cheney to turn to one of the larger hydrocarbon-based companies and say, look, you are going to go renewable. We are going to support you. You are going to get out of the hydrocarbon industry, and you're going to lead the rest of us out of this hydrocarbon wilderness. But, you know, change is hard. You know, and it's difficult to get people to change their direction. I think it's really encouraging when I see Exxon putting, you know, and BP and Shell and Chevron putting renewables in their ads. I think it's even more encouraging when I see Exxon put the word nuclear in their renewable, you know, advertisements to consumers, because they're being honest about, you know, what it's going to take to replace, you know, our sort of, you know, our hydrocarbon-based society.
I'll let you know, I have a vested interest in asking that question, because one of my constantly repeated theories is that the law of supply and demand is not a passive voice law. Those who are in the business of supplying commodities understand that law very clearly, and they understand your mathematics about making $4 on sales of $100 or four percent on sales of a few billion dollars.
Right, exactly. So
if they can drive the price up by restricting supply, that is pure profit.
Well, it just sounds like a corollary, Rod, to the golden rules. You know, he who has the gold rules. It sounds like a corollary to that. You know, the thing is that the big industry does change, and they'll change for lots of reasons. But people have to understand that they've got to be motivated ultimately by profit. That is their responsibility. You know, there's a big argument from an economist standpoint between, you know, the corporations exist for the benefit of shareholders, or do they benefit for the benefit of society as a whole? I think you can do both. I think it's really easy to only do one. I think it's harder to do both. And if, you know, in America, you can maybe get away is too strong a language, but you can pursue the profit goal and forget the societal goal very comfortably until somebody yanks your chain back. I mean, there's many examples, you know, for this happening, and they're all based in this concept of a quote-unquote free market. I don't think there's such thing as a free market, but you know, totally free market. But, you know, government exists as a place, in my mind, for people to come together, and it should become a checkpoint for when someone's profit motive is hurting society. We're getting pretty close, you know, with some of the major energy players out there. But you know, everything kind of evens out. That's the Jerry Seinfeld rule, right? In the end, everything kind of evens out. And I believe that, you know, we'll see a leveling or even evening out of energy. I don't believe we're in an energy crisis. I think we're having an energy panic. And there's a big difference there. You know, there,
yeah, there's a lot of money to be made in panics. And I'm with you on the where I draw the line between my support for private industry and my belief that it's possible for companies to forget what their customers really need,
right,
and to enjoy high profits briefly, because the customers will figure out a way around paying excess prices.
Right. I mean, it's the heroin analogy, you know. If it's too cheap, someone's going to get too messed up on it and make themselves sick. If it's too expensive, they're not going to get what they need. They're going to start looking for alternative methods of getting what they need, and sometimes they're violent. I certainly don't suggest that's going to happen with U.S. energy market, but, you know, when people talk about the oil industry being a drug we need to get off of, or my favorite silly thing is, you know, energy independence. That doesn't exist. You know, that's a political platitude. There is not an independent anything on this planet anymore. You can't be energy independent and be worried about, you know, what your downstream waste emissions are going to do to the rest of the planet. You've created a dependence. Whether
right.
you're importing oil or, you know, you're blowing your smokestack junk, you know, into the jet stream and watching it flutter over Northern Europe. This
yeah,
is an interdependent world.
Yeah, I like to talk a little bit more like, I want to be a social drinker of energy, where I can take it or leave it.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the marketplace, I'd like to be able to trade with anybody, but if
right.
that anybody is offering a deal that I don't like, I want to be able to walk away, and I want the country to be able to do that right now.
Right.
And I think that the biggest challenge we have right now is that not just the U.S., but Europe as well, are dependent to the point of obsequiousness to some very nasty people, whether it be Putin or some other folks.
Right. You know, one of my other theories, I told you I had a background in geography and certainly in geomorphology and economic geography, so I worry about, you know, why things are located where they are and how do you get access to resources and social costs and the true, you know, monetary economic costs. I think the next big shortage is water. Forget energy, right? I mean, I'm looking 50 years down the road. We already have severe water shortages. But wouldn't it be great if we could, you know, and again, this is, you know, something like T. Boone Pickens standing up and saying this, wouldn't it be great if we could get off at least foreign oil? You know, because that would create a different kind of dynamic in the global marketplace. And one thing the U.S. is really good at, the United States of America is really good at innovation. We're the only ones that are this good at it. Everybody else kind of copies what we're doing. And you look at even what Toshiba's doing with their 4S reactor, it's sort of like the miniaturization of a, you know, transistor radio, which is something that, you know, Sony Corp started their business with. That all kind of makes sense to me. But wouldn't it be great if, you know, our innovations lead to the ability to clean water, generate clean electricity at a reasonable price point, something that, you know, the market will truly dictate, not be succumbed to, and food. And we are really good at innovation. So that takes care of the water component, the energy component, and we are really good at growing food. You know, so
we're also pretty good at eating it. Looking around at my Americans,
that's how you know, right? I mean, if you've traveled internationally, I go to Japan and I'm not fat, but geez, I'm embarrassed. You know,
yeah.
Just because I'm a 200-pound, 6-foot tall guy, I feel like So anyhow, I think that, you know, the next big conflicts are going to be over food and water, and quite honestly, you know, I think that's
with heat, the world's got plenty of water.
Yeah, right. That's this concept of the energy-water nexus, right, that you hear people like at Sandia National Lab. They commissioned this whole, you know, thing and this whole study that Senator Pete DiBenedetti paid for, and it gets this great, you know, water research facility down there at Sandia. They've come up with this theory that if you have as much water as you need, then you can have as much electricity as you want. Meaning you could ultimately, I guess, use hydro. Or if you've got as much electricity as you need, or need to have, then you can have as much clean water as you want. And that concept is what drove myself and our associates to managing and running Hyperion Power Generation. That idea that we can provide clean, reasonably priced or cheap, if you will, electricity anywhere in the world means we can provide clean water. So, to a certain extent, we're in the water business. You know, we're in the hydrocarbon business because we want to provide a more efficient way of extracting, heavy hydrocarbons out of oil sands and shale.
Okay, so let's ask the tough question. How much do you think a million BTUs of heat from a Hyperion reactor is going to cost?
We've done some fairly detailed analysis of this, and we've had this validated again by a couple of our strategic partners, and we're at about $3 a million BTUs.
Okay, that's pretty good compared to current prices of natural gas, which is somewhere around $8 here in the U.S. and $16 internationally.
Right, and the spot market drives that up. I mean, I checked this price the other day, and natural gas was $11. But that doesn't, get that natural gas up into, Fort McMurray out in northern Canada. So that's where, but our $3 will get it up there, right? I mean, you don't have to, you literally will deliver the reactor, it's sealed to the factory, we'll pick it up. That's the model we're working on. So when the oil and gas industry looks at our solution, they're looking at something that goes in the back of the truck that will save them 80% of their cost. Holy cow, now heavy hydrocarbons are actually, economic, right?
Right.
They make economic sense. Right now those guys are spending 30 to 40% of every joule, BTU, calorie, dollar, or however you want it, whatever unit you want to use, they pull out of the ground, they're spending 30 to 40% just pulling them out of the ground. Today's oil prices, that doesn't make sense. We got to get gasoline at $7-$8 a gallon before current technology using heavy hydrocarbons make total economic sense.
Yeah, there's also a whole bunch of island nations around the world that are paying between $19 and $50 per million BTUs.
Yep. Well, on a kilowatt-hour basis, because that's kind of what I've been looking at, I know the Bahamas are paying about 42 cents a kilowatt-hour.
Right.
I'm sorry, the Cayman Islands. And then, Guam and Tinian, those are U.S., citizens out there, they're paying 35 cents a kilowatt hour.
Hawaii's paying 30.
Yeah, I pay 8 cents in downtown Denver.
Yep, and there's people in South Carolina paying 7 cents. So this is great. One other question I got for you.
Sure.
Because I've been in the looking at small reactors for a long time.
Oh, I know.
One challenge that we all face if we like small reactors is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission fee structure for licenses right now assumes that all reactors are the same, and power reactors are power reactor from their fee structure. And I believe right now the current annual license fee for a power reactor is $4 million. What are you doing about that?
Yeah, well, that's a gigawatt reactor, right? That's the big nuke, industry.
That's the rules are written right now anyway.
Right.
Unless the rules get changed, a power reactor is a power reactor.
Right. And look, the people I've talked to at the NRC, which are not insignificant folks in that organization, know what's coming. It's because of the work that we're doing, NuScale's doing. They've got to change the paradigm here, and it's not going to be economic for somebody to look at that kind of annual license and overhead. The NRC is full of a bunch of smart people. They know what's coming. The fee structure will change. I'm not worried about that. We're still almost 5 years away from putting our first unit in the ground. We got a lot of work to do between now and then. We're definitely working on the regulatory side to make sure that, what we are doing makes sense. But I'm not concerned about, the current fee structure being applied to our users in the future.
I'm not really either, but I've had several venture capitalists who were.
Who were worried about it?
Yeah, several of the people that I've made presentations to over the years.
Well,
that
if venture capitalists really knew what they were doing, they'd be running the company, wouldn't they? No, I'm just kidding. I've spent my whole career raising money and spending money out of venture capitalist pockets. And they would tell you that they're not operators. That's why they're venture capitalists. It's definitely part of the risk component in what we're doing. We are working on it. And, you know, it involves a multi-pronged approach. You've got to look at it from the customer standpoint. You've got to look at it from the regulatory standpoint, the legal standpoint, legislative standpoint. There's a bunch of things that one has to do. Certainly, you know, the NEI, the Nuclear Energy Institute, of which we're members, are working that direction. I think you're going to see a lot more people worried about this. But quite honestly, you know, until somebody walks up and says, hey, I've got a small reactor I want to license, you know, and in our case, it's a design certification, then a manufacturing license, you know, it's our customers I'm worried about, right? That's where it's going to hurt us. And, you know, so we know and we are, you know, working diligently on making sure that people understand it. But everything I've heard from the NRC is, look, you know, a COL cannot, combined operating license, you know, for a small reactor is not going to cost what it costs for a big reactor. End of story.
Yep.
So let's figure out how to deal with it.
I'm with you on the multi-pronged approach. This is part of my prongs.
Yeah, there you go. Well, and, you know, Rod, I've followed your blog and your site and stuff. I mean, you've done a lot to contribute to the industry, and I think that, you know, we've got to have more people that are willing to stand up and say, you know, look, here's what I think. Here's what you guys should be looking at. You know, come out of the closet, as it were. I actually did a presentation for an All Saints conference up in Calgary, and I made everybody, and there was a couple hundred guys, you know, these are all roughneck-looking guys, right? It's an Oil Sands conference. A few seats in the back, you knew they were either management or finance. Had them stand up and hold their hand up in an oath, and at the end of my presentation, made them say, I will no longer be afraid of nuclear energy. And they thought that was the greatest thing. So, you know, it does take that, you know, one-on-one. You've got to sit down and educate people. You know, you've got to provide great resources for the research on the Internet. You've got to do a million presentations. You've got to do that grassroots kind of work to get people to take a closer look at benefits of nuclear energy.
Yeah, and I think that you're already finding that something that I've found is that, in general, people are curious. They may repeat what they've heard, but if they're really intellectually honest, they come away saying, wow, I didn't know all that stuff.
Yeah.
There are a few who have their minds made up. They're locked like a steel trap.
Right.
And they're never going to change, and I accept that. That's okay. There are people that have ulterior motives for their position as well.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, that's again,
not my problem.
Part of the mix. You know, we're just doing our part for a small, you know, albeit $100 billion segment, but small part of the total energy generation market. And you know, we'll focus on what we do well and do what we can to help the broader, you know, industries, all the industries. I'd love to see the hydrocarbon industry, you know, come over to our side and really explore alternative and renewable sources of energy in a way that allows them to be around 200 years from now and not be, you know, sort of gone the way of, you know, the old-fashioned company. So.
Yeah, but it's going to be really hard to convince somebody who's making $12 billion every 3 months that they need to change what they're doing.
Yeah, well, you know.
I mean, that's so much fun. It's got to
be.
Yeah,
sure. You know,
I can only say that because I can look at it. I can't imagine what it's like.
Well, and they, you know, I mean, they put a lot of money to risk on that to make that $12 billion. And again, you know, it's got to do with quantity and price. So to the extent that they see their margins starting to shrink because people have found alternative energies, they'll react to the marketplace or they'll go out of business. There's only two options, you know, adapt or die. And the world is adapting to a non-hydrocarbon-based, you know, energy generation, you know, paradigm. And the big energy, you know, hydrocarbon energy guys will adapt or they will go out of business.
Over the long term, I couldn't agree with you more, but over the short term, powerful industries have one other option called the Heisman.
the Heisman.
You know, that stiff arm pose that the Heisman Trophy winner wears. Keep away. Stay away.
Right.
Don't interrupt our profits. Okay.
Well, when, you know, so, we're talking about generating, you know, 4 or 5 cents of essentially kilowatt anywhere in the world. You know, when fuel oil is costing, you know, driving the cost of generating electricity out there, you know, where people are paying 45, 50 cents, you know, a kilowatt hour, they're going to lose. Yep. They're going to lose, you know, a kilowatt hour at a time. It'll take us a long time to catch up with them, but they're going to lose.
Yep.
So, that, you know, again, they need to, they've got to adapt, and I think they're smart enough to do that. I can't imagine there's not, you know, every hydrocarbon based or every hydrocarbon, you know, generating or mining company out there has somebody, maybe they're tucked away in a closet and they have a green eye shade on, but somebody's worried about, you know, Hubert's Peak. Somebody is worried about the decline of their industry and, you know, get it while they can. So, you know, filled up my truck the other day. It cost me $110. Get it while you can.
I agree with you. All right. Except I'm looking forward to the time when everyone in the world can have access to that 5 to 6 cents per kilowatt hour power.
So much. So much. It's worth spending our time on. Isn't that a cool thing? I think it's worth. It's a worthy cause. And
it's exciting to get up every day and think about how to make that move just a little bit closer.
Right, make that a reality. So.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Grizz. And I'll say for the next time, I'll ask you about where Grizz came from.
Absolutely. And next time you want to talk about carbon sequestration and conversion, and how I think carbon sequestration is a big lie, we'll talk about that.
Okay. You
Take
got
your
it.
Time, Rod.
Take care.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
There's a way is such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.